This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
I'm Helena Bonham Carter, and for BBC Radio 4, this is History's Secret Heroes, a new series of rarely heard tales from World War II.
They had no idea that she was Britain's top female codebreaker.
We'll hear of daring risk-takers.
What she was offering to do was to ski in over the high Carpathian Mountains.
Of course it was dangerous, but danger was his friend.
Subscribe to History's Secret Heroes wherever you get your podcasts.
Thanks for downloading the In Our Time podcast. For more details about In Our Time and for our terms of use, please go to bbc.co.uk/radio4. I hope you enjoy the programme. Hello. In a celebrated case brought before the District Court of New York in December 1932, Judge John Woolsey was asked to decide whether James Joyce's novel Ulysses was obscene. The book had been banned shortly after its publication 10 years earlier, following outrage about its sexual content. Judge Woolsey's ruling is an unusual combination of legal reasoning and shrewd literary criticism. Ulysses, he wrote, is not an easy book to read or to understand. After describing the work as a serious experiment in a new literary genre, he calls it an amazing tour de force and its author a great artist in words. Overturning the ban, the judge concluded that the work was not obscene, but a sincere and serious attempt to devise a new literary method for the observation and description of mankind. Ulysses describes a single day in the lives of the Dubliners Leopold Bloom and Stephen Dedalus. It's packed with classical allusions, often difficult and experimental writing, but it's also funny and earthy, music-hall and rude. And it's generally regarded as a, if not the, towering masterpiece of modern fiction. With me to discuss James Joyce's Ulysses are Stephen Connor, Professor of Modern Literature and Theory at Birkbeck University of London, Jerry Johnson, Senior Fellow in English at Exeter College, Oxford, and Richard Brown, Reader in Modern English Literature at the University of Leeds. Steve Connor, James Joyce was born in 1882 and grew up in Dublin. Would you tell us something about his early life?
Well, he was one from a member of a very large family, what became in the end 10 children, son of a larger-than-life character, kind of improvident father. So nevertheless, he was able to have a really very kind of intensely academic education, which stood him in very good stead, during a period in which Ireland was experiencing a huge kind of upsurge of cultural self-confidence, which came dramatically to a halt in 1889 with the death of the Irish parliamentary leader who led the Home Rule movement, and everyone thought that Home Rule was going to come. His name was Charles Stuart Parnell. And as a result of a sexual scandal, he fell from power, died shortly afterwards. Thereafter, there was a kind of parting of the ways. Ireland itself, the Irish literary revival, continued, but it's been thought by many in a very much more introverted way. There was a kind of mystical or mental revolution that took the place of something secular and political. Joyce turned aside from that. As a young man, his point was to try to forge some much larger sense of his own identity, a European sense, not a narrowly Irish one.
Let's go back to education for a moment. He was the eldest in what became 10 children. The father was well off at the start. So he got a classical education at a good public school in Ireland, based on English public schools, and he went to Dublin University, the Royal University of Dublin, then called, as a classical scholar, but also specialising in modern language. So this was a very solid Enlightenment education.
Very solid. Lots of theology, lots of classical education. Which although Joyce turned away from the theology, he never forgot it and remained deeply, he was educated in fact at school by Jesuits and remained deeply appreciative.
Deeply saturated.
Saturated was his word, yes.
Yes, in Roman Catholicism,
in those forms of thought. But he was also open to, I mean, he also had intense linguistic consciousness. He was studying French and German, I believe. He deliberately also studied Italian and taught himself at the age of 17 what then was Norwegian and now is a bit closer to Danish, in order to study the works of Henrik Ibsen.
So we have a man, a young boy, who's got the best education that can be provided, and he takes to it, and he takes to Catholicism deeply before he rejects it.
Yes.
He's a Dubliner as well, so he knows what a colonial city is like. He knows what being under imperial rule and yet being against those who are officially against imperial rule. So there's quite a lot going on there. Gerry Johnson, he left Ireland in 1902 and moved to Trieste with his lover, Nora Barnacle. When did he start writing and what were his earliest works?
Well, he went to Paris in 1902, came back and then left for Trieste in Pola in 1904. And in 1904, he's publishing already short stories. He's asked by A.E. to provide short stories for that strange magazine, The Irish Homestead, a combination of agricultural advice and high literature. And he publishes under the pseudonym of Stephen Dedalus, three stories, which become three of the stories in Dubliners. He's already published an essay on Ibsen, Drama as Life, and from the continent, attempts to get Dubliners published. Is unsuccessful.
Dubliners will be a collection of short stories.
That's right, a collection of short stories. He tries to get these published unsuccessfully. There are complaints about possible obscenity. There are complaints about offence to the English king. He does eventually get them published by 1914. By that point, he's already started a second book, which is, at that point, Stephen Hero, a quasi-autobiographical novel. He grows frustrated with it, understandably. It's a kind of, as Hugh Kenner says, a run-of-the-mill Edwardian novel. Nothing exciting, nothing particularly interesting about it. So he throws that away and starts again, and begins what becomes Portrait of the Artist. So as early as 1907, he's starting Portrait of the Artist, a book which really is a modernist novel in its style and its technique and in its construction.
Can you tell us what bearing the Portrait of the Artist as a young man had on Ulysses, how it was a precursor of Ulysses?
Absolutely. The most obvious thing is its central character. Portrait of the Artist is a Bildungsroman, a novel about the growth and development of an individual. That individual looks an awful lot like James Joyce.
So we're talking about autobiographical fiction here.
Absolutely. Though Joyce, being Joyce, is one to challenge the very notions of autobiography, but yes, the events of Stephen's life...
All autobiographers
life,
are.
Yeah, of course. The events of Stephen's life are the events of Joyce's life, rearranged for the purposes of fiction. The second most important thing, it seems to me, is the style in which the book is written. It is intensely close to Stephen. It isn't...
What do you mean by that, precisely?
It's written in the third person. In other words, Stephen is always a he.
He
crossed the road rather than I crossed the road. Nevertheless, the style in which that third person narrative proceeds is attached to the growing mind of the young boy.
So can you give us an example how that works?
Well, right at the beginning, the story begins with his father telling him a story. Once upon a time, there was a moo cow coming down along the road, and this moo cow that was coming down along the road met a nice-ins little boy named Baby Taku. So very childish, very simple prose. But as the book proceeds over five distinctive chapters, the style becomes more mature. At times, it becomes unbearably precious, as Stephen becomes unbearably precious. So it's very, very...
Do you think that's unconscious or conscious?
On whose part? Stephen's or Joyce's?
Joyce's.
Do you
think he's becoming unbearably precious, or he wants Stephen to become unbearably precious?
I think he wants Stephen to become unbearably precious. Joyce famously said about the book, if only anybody would recognize that it said a portrait of the artist as a young man. So he's standing in some ironic distance to Stephen. But the important thing here is that he's connecting character to style. So a particular language use is identifying of the character itself.
Have you got an example to hand?
Well, the whole of Portrait of the Artist, as it grows,
But can you give us something more specific?
I don't have the book to hand, but any sentence there will do. If we think for a minute ahead, I know I'm getting ahead here, but of Ulysses, We have three primary characters in the text, each of whom has an identifying style. So Leopold Bloom writes in staccato, or thinks in staccato sentences. Stephen, still very precious, is thinking in long, involuted sentences, complex, subordinate clauses, and so on. And Molly Bloom thinks, in the end, wholly without punctuation in a continuous flow.
Thank you very much. Now, Richard Brown, I made a mistake. I said he went to Dresden, Daniel too, he went to Paris, but it's slightly difficult to keep up with him when he and Nora go to the continent. It's Paris, I'm not accusing myself, I made a mistake. Paris, Trieste, Zurich, and so on and so forth. They're knocking around very much, and that's when he began to work on this book, Ulysses. But I want to have a digression here, if I may. Mm-hmm. He had met Nora Barnacle, a chambermaid from Galway. He'd met her in Dublin. He'd taken her out one night. And that seems to have been an evening, it's not a night, seems to be an earthquake in his sexuality and his vision of womanhood. Was it as important as I am suggesting it might be?
I think it's a very important part of the Joyce story, and for that reason, a very important part of Joyce's development. Steve mentioned his education, Joyce's hyper-scholarly education, his education super-saturated in Catholicism. And I suspect many people would have expected Joyce to have found a partner with a similar kind of fascination with the scholarly, perhaps with the theological. And Nora was the absolute opposite of that. She was an ordinary girl.
She seems to be quite an extraordinary girl, I mean, doesn't she? I mean, she sort of got hold of him one way and another on that night and never let go.
Well, absolutely extraordinary in those terms. you're absolutely right.
Also, there's an exchange of scatological letters between them, which we're not allowed to talk about, and I was not allowed to include in a programme we did many years ago because they're so sort of scatological.
Yes, you're absolutely right.
And that was on
right.
both sides. So there's a lot going on. I think we should put that in the mix because that's part of what was going on when Ulysses was written.
Yes, well, you're absolutely right. It's very, very important. It's also important, I suppose, to remember that those letters were written when Joyce was back on a trip to Dublin, leaving Nora in Trieste. He was actually back in Dublin for a very interesting reason, because he'd been asked to set up the first cinema, what would have been the first cinema in Dublin, by a group of Triestine businessmen. There he was in Dublin, Nora, who he'd eloped with, left in warm Trieste, and all of a sudden that contrast between the northern European city and its gloomy memories for Joyce and the warm, sunny south of Trieste
came to his mind. That's a nice description, but I think that they were mad about each other in the most as far as you could go, and it did change his life. Now, that's simple, it may be, but I don't think anything you've said contradicts it.
No, absolutely not. No.
Did he have when he started Ulysses, did he lay out an agenda? Because he spoke about it very grandly all the time. Mm-hmm. This was going to be a 20th century masterpiece. Mm-hmm. His confidence is quite wonderful. Where did he get that from? Mm-hmm. This was going to be the greatest book written in the 20th century. Mm-hmm. So he knew from the beginning what he wanted to do with this book, did he?
I'm not so sure about that. I think it's a book which makes a lot more sense if you think about it as being written over a long period of time, as you've said, in a variety of different places around Europe, and with a changing agenda and a complicating agenda as he works through it. The first first written account we have of the book is him referring to a story about somebody called Hunter in Ulysses, a man rumoured to have a wife who was being unfaithful, and that story was to be called Ulysses, and he says in a letter it never got forwarder than the title. Well, perhaps in some ways, because it's such an interesting title, it never got forwarder than the title, and it did continue to return to that title. But certainly the novel changed and developed during that time, so that by the time Joyce finished the novel, he was having to enlist a group of contemporary critics and intellectuals to explain to them quite how complex his various intentions were.
Can we turn to once more, maybe the last time, the influences on him while he was going around these European cities? Mm-hmm. We talk about literature. I think one of the two great influences is he is the biggest influence on himself, is plundering his life all the time and his life in Dublin. And also, Nora is a massive influence. Putting that aside, what are the literary influences, the things we can talk about nicely, what are they on about?
His own life and his experience with Nora, his love experience with Nora, those things are absolutely embedded in the experience.
I hate God and death, but I love Nora. Nora.
Exactly. Beautiful letters, wonderful, powerful letter. And yet, of course, all of literature somehow or other gets subsumed in Ulysses.
So what's he reading in these 7 years?
Well, almost everything. When he arrives in Rome, for example, to work as a bank clerk, he finds himself passing by Shelley's house in Rome. So the English literary tradition is there. When he's in Trieste, everything played into Joyce's hands. You know, one of his first students was most interesting students in Trieste was Italo Svevo, the writer who's terribly interested in Joyce's writing, and himself a medium for important intellectual movements in Europe, like psychoanalysis at the time. Trieste was the place where the Italian futurists celebrated what they were doing. For them, Venice was passé. Trieste was a new city of the future. So Joyce's exciting connection with new avant-garde movements in art really reinforced by him being there.
And his interest in European literature, which, let us say, was anchored in Ibsen when his young man continued with Hauptmann and various European writers he was reading. Stephen Connor, can you describe the outlines of the work for those listeners who might not know it, the plot and structure?
So we have two central characters, Leopold Bloom, who's a middle-aged advertising canvasser, so somebody who places adverts and takes commission in the newspapers, and Stephen Dedalus. It's a story of them both getting up, wandering around a bit, doing a bit of work, almost meeting each other, and finally actually meeting each other. That's it in capsule form. It's very important to remember that it's a Thursday, and Thursday was a half holiday. So hardly anybody is doing any work, so there's plenty of opportunity for them to meet people. So they there's a funeral. Leopold Bloom goes to the funeral of Patrick Dignam. Stephen Dedalus goes to work teaching in a school in the morning. They have a couple of near misses, one in a newspaper office where Bloom has gone to place an advert, another in the National Library where Bloom has gone to do some research on nude statues, and he wants to find out if they have anuses. And they finally meet at the end of the day, in, of all places, a maternity hospital. From there, they proceed increasingly drunk, Stephen increasingly drunk, to a brothel, eventually wander home to Bloom's house, where they have a cup of cocoa. They go out into the garden, urinate together, and say goodbye.
So it's quite a simple day in the life of two men, really. Without being silly about it, it is. On top of that, you've said it quite briskly and clearly, and not much was missed out in certain skeletal plot terms. Now you've got a quarter of a million words to describe that. There's Molly at the end of it. We can bring Molly Bloom in later. She does indeed come in later. So one of the things that people say about the book is that he loaded it with so much difficulty that they find, much as they want to read it, they find themselves stopped from time to time. And he himself said, and I'm quoting from your notes, Stephen, he said, "I put in so many enigmas and puzzles that it will keep the professors busy for centuries arguing over what I meant." What did he mean by saying that, in a way? I mean, it's obviously true, but did he want everybody to know this is for scholars only, or did he want to give it a particular allure?
No, not a bit. Actually, the kinds of enigmas and puzzles are what come from when you don't edit things out in the way in which scholars edit things out and the way in which novelists previously had edited things out. One of the most puzzling episodes in the book when you read it for the first time is Bloom meets a character called Bantam Lyons, and Bantam Lyons says, "Can I have a look at your newspaper? I want to see who's running in the Ascot Gold Cup." And Bloom says, "Yeah, you can have it. I was just going to throw it away." Bantam Lyons looks at him and says, "I'll chance it," and runs off. And you don't know until later in the book that he thinks Bloom is giving him a tip for a horse called Throwaway. A horse called Throwaway did, in fact, win the Ascot Gold Cup on the 16th of June, 1904, at odds of 20-1. So Bloom gets in a lot of trouble because everyone thinks he's made a lot of money on the race. That's not esoteric stuff. Well, it is in a way, but it's not the same kind of esoteric allusion that people are usually put off by. It's certainly true you need a bit of help. But you would need a bit of help if you were engaging in the intricacies and the intimacies of any ordinary person's life. And that's the kind of difficulty. It's the difficulty of the ordinariness that Joyce will not edit out.
I agree with that. I'm just railing in for this programme, and it is wonderful. But I'm just trying to be on the side of quite a people who said, looking forward to the programme, couldn't finish it. Mm. And one of the things is it does go on and on sometimes. But let's come back to that in a moment. Jerry Johnson, Ulysses is the Latin name for Odysseus, the hero of Homer's epic poem, The Odyssey. How does that how does Homer's Iliad play into, not the Iliad.
The Odyssey.
Thank you very much. Homer's Odyssey play into Joyce's Ulysses.
From very early age, Joyce adored Homer, as he puts it. He studied Homer at school, studied the Odyssey. He said, repeatedly asked people who they thought the best character was in the whole of literature, the best all-round man, that seemed to be Odysseus for Joyce. You saw him as a father, you saw him as a husband, you saw him as a warrior, you saw him as an adventurer, you saw him as a king, etc. So Joyce had this idea of working what T.S. Eliot calls a continuous parallel between antiquity and contemporaneity, of using as a kind of ground plan the Odyssey. Joyce actually early on had read Charles Lamb's Adventures of Ulysses rather than the Odyssey itself, and that reconfigures the Odyssey into discrete tales, as it were. So Joyce takes 18...
The Cyclops tale, for instance.
The Cyclops, exactly. Yeah. The Cyclops, Nausicaa, Calypso, Telemachus. So a narrative unit around an individual character of the Odyssey. So Joyce takes that as a structural template, if you like. We have 18 episodes of Ulysses paralleled with 18 episodes of the Odyssey. So each of them, though they were never published this way, has for Joyce a title corresponding to one of those episodes.
He drew up graphs and maps about it.
He certainly did. Yes. He produced at least two what we call schemata.
Yeah.
Each episode has an hour of the day, it has an organ of the body, it has a Ulyssean parallel. It has a whole cast of characters that are in their ways elusive of these Odyssean or Homeric characters.
And that's a powerful and a witty idea in every possible way. But if you look at Bloom,
yep,
and you look at the other Ulysses, Bloom is transparent, he's honest, he's careful, he's not slow, but he's extremely cautious. He goes through the day in what can only be called a pedestrian in every sense manner, although he's an interesting character, obviously. But Odysseus is this flaming sword going through the Mediterranean, and he's the trickster, he's the hero. Now, is it a way of saying, I will attach significance to this by the name, or is there a deeper significance there that we are supposed to take for granted? Is any man's day an odyssey? Is that what he's saying?
In one sense, he is saying that, but Joyce always, at the same time, maintained that Odysseus was a good man and that his Leopold Bloom was going to be a good man.
Well, that's easy, isn't it? I mean, that doesn't take you very far.
That doesn't take you very far. But he's also canny, and he gets out of scrapes now and then and so on. But I agree with you that there's a way in which I've often thought that if Joyce hadn't told us about this Homeric parallel, that in reading the book, one would find it very difficult to find such parallels.
That's an honest thing to say. Stephen's got your hand. If so, where does that leave us with Joyce's sort of intention? Is this a bit of wonderful...
I just want to say that there's a reason why it's the Odyssey and not the Iliad.
Yes.
And that is because the Iliad is full of fighting and killing. The first word of the Iliad is wrath, the wrath of Achilles, let me tell you. And Joyce thought that, you know, Ulysses did what he did through guile, through tricksiness, through storytelling. And Joyce,
but does Bloom do that, Stephen?
Well, Bloom does. Bloom averts wrath in the chapter that's known as the Cyclops chapter. He averts the wrath of a very
man with a monocle,
bigoted, Irish nationalist. And he doesn't, you know, avoid it, but he averts it. He confronts it, stands up to it, and escapes from it. And I think the book is about those forms of escape from various forms of temptation, seduction, the seductions of fantasy, especially where those seductions of fantasy can lead to violence, which Joyce loathed. So this is the great book of peace.
Mm-hmm. You want to come in, Richard?
Well, I think the idea of Ulysses being a tricksy hero, as you mentioned, is a really important one for Joyce, not just for the character of Leopold Bloom in the book, but for the character of the book as a whole. There's a lovely letter that Joyce wrote with an illustration of Odysseus and Leopold Bloom, with a bowler hat on, and the first line from the Odyssey in Greek written above it. And, of course, that tricksiness of Odysseus is the word polytropos. Well, for modern literary critics, the polytropism, if you like, the fact that the book is full of different literary tropes and styles makes it the book that it is. And, of course, that shifts our idea of the relationship between the book and the hero Odysseus, because it partly makes Leopold Bloom the hero Odysseus, but I think also it makes the reader of the book a kind of hero on a voyage like the voyage of Odysseus through this complex textual adventure.
Stephen Connor, let's go into this very wide range of styles in the novel. Can you give a listener some idea of the range, briskly, and then pick out one bit that you think exemplifies it?
Yes.
At its most,
this is not apparent really for the first six or so episodes. No. Not really. I mean, you could be reading realistic fiction. There are moves in and out of the internal and the external. In Bloom's first appearance, we have a sentence that goes, "Gelid warm sunlight filled his kitchen." Made you feel
marvelous.
A bit peckish.
I mean, the sense of 19th century prose at its most brilliant.
But we move into Bloom's mind instantly, made you feel a bit peckish. And then, but that's not very, very surprising. Things really start, as we currently say, to kick off in episode, I think it's 7, which is set in...
Can't you say kick off, do you? This is the new scholar. Oh, we're just kicking off one.
Yes. Well, right, this then is very Joycean, because the Joycean principle that we see emerge from about chapter 7 onwards is that the context of any scene starts to have a voice in it. In other words, the chapter called The Aeolus chapter is set in a newspaper office, and it's set out like a newspaper with headlines. Thereafter, the styles of the chapter increasingly take on the character, not of the individual characters who feature in them necessarily, but of Joyce's understanding of the entire context. So the Circe episode is written as a play. It's almost as long as a novel itself. It's about 150 pages in most editions. That's set out as a play precisely because it seems as though everything in the brothel where it's set, everything is speaking, everything is, as it were, trying to muscle in on the action. It's as though Joyce wants to dramatise or display for us his own removal or withdrawal, so the book itself is somehow knitting itself or speaking itself together.
Would you like to develop that, Joy?
Well, there are different styles attached to different, as it were, in some instances, the Homeric characters, so Cyclops, the one-eyed giant, is narrated by a single narrator, interrupted by gigantic prose bits. It's also the case, though, that for the first half of the novel, what I was talking about earlier in relation to Portrait of the Artist is developed here so that what Stephen was describing as the interior bits, as what Joyce calls interior monologue, that means first person, present tense, without any narratorial, external narratorial direction saying Bloom thought, Stephen thought, and so on.
And lots of half-sentences and stops and starts and one-word sentences.
Absolutely, because we don't think usually in complete sentences. We catch snippets of
perception. We know we don't
perception.
Think in complete sentences.
Yeah. So that makes it difficult at times. Once you recognise that you're getting Bloom unmediated by an external narrator, then that becomes easy to develop. And it goes back to what I was saying earlier about style as connected to the character. Mm. So that there are various styles in the book, and halfway through, in fact, that device of interior monologue stops, and the explosion of styles, each of which is describing not merely a series of events, but is commenting on, you thought that was the way to tell a story? Well, here's a very different way, and think about the implications of this different mode of telling.
Is it a sensible question? If it isn't, let's get on with it. to ask if his determination, obsession, joy in many styles and doing the newspaper and doing the play and doing the sights and so on and so forth and doing these long internal monologues. One of the problems is which you can't the sense of validity and veracity can go quite quickly, and a creeping slight bemusement can set in. Is there a sense in which that is both a strength and a point of criticism about the novel?
Well, it's certainly one of the points at which all of one's students begin to say, what on earth is this about? How can I figure out what's really going on with Stephen and Bloom, for example? Oxen of the Sun, which gives you the whole history of English prose style. Most people come to a screeching halt there and think, oh my God, what's going on? So there can be that kind of frustration. But we go back to what Richard was saying, and Steve, both, that the part of the adventure of this book, and one of the reasons it is often cited as the great work of modernism, is that the adventure isn't just the human adventure, a very real adventure between Stephen and Bloom and in the end Molly, but is that adventure of language. Joyce famously said, I've discovered I can do anything I want with language. And if you can't be delighted at what language can do, then Ulysses may not be the book for you. At least that second half of it.
Well, there's a kaleidoscope of styles, but it's underpinned by this kind of bedding of actuality. I mean, this is a realistic book, ultimately. And I mean, the principle of what's sometimes nowadays called consilience often applies. That's to say, you get the same thing seen from two different points of view. Sometimes something, a cloud covers the sun and makes both Stephen and Bloom at different times in different chapters a little gloomy for a moment. So you get lots of moments of convergence or triangulation like that happen that hold it all together. Mm.
Richard Brown, can we return to the three main characters just for a moment, just to sort of, as it were, catch up? You have Leopold, who's Jewish Irish. Mm-hmm. You have Stephen, who's scholar, as it were. Do you say failed Catholic or whatever it is? I mean, he never leaves him. He never leaves it. And then you have Molly. Can you just as it were, tick those boxes again?
Well, as Steve just said, of course, one of the exciting things about Ulysses is the way in which it does give us these three quite distinct perspectives. Bloom walking round the Dublin streets of the day with the experiences and the anxieties and the anticipations.
And they act as Dublin streets they are, aren't they?
All very real Dublin streets. Yeah. In fact, if you go to Dublin now, you can see plaques embedded in the pavement at the places where...
Every paving stone is a plaque.
Almost. and it is, of course, absolutely fascinating the way in which Bloom's experience of the city and that of the other characters, but particularly Bloom, unpacks an idea of a particular city at a particular time. It's another of the great strengths of the book. But Bloom, in his daily life, with his, if you like, fatherly, middle-aged man kind of anxieties and responsibilities, the concerns that he feels during the course of the day, his weaknesses, but also the good things that he does. Stephen, on the other hand, much darker in his mood, in a way. Well,
22, 23-year-old
intellectual, I should say. His mum's died recently, so he's in mourning, melancholic about that. Incredibly intellectually ambitious. We were talking about the styles earlier. I sometimes say to my students, what do you think about when you walk along the beach? And what Stephen thinks about when he walks along the beach, it begins with this marvellous bit of intellectual prose, ineluctable modality of the visible.
We'll leave that with the listener. And there's Molly.
And, of course, there's Molly. Joe was saying about the relationship between style and character in the book.
We've got to get Molly on the map as soon as we can.
Right. So Molly, in her 30s, married woman in her 30s, with a daughter. She doesn't think so much about her daughter.
But she's a singer. And when we meet her, she's going to give a concert that afternoon.
Yeah.
And she's going to have an affair.
Mm-hmm.
And she's going to talk about the affair and the massive end of the book, which a lot of people bought it for in the first instance.
Yep.
And at the end, decides we feel that... And this enormous, non-stop passage is one of the great set pieces of the book.
I think it's a great place to start the book. If you're a reader and you're not sure where to begin the book, then
start at the end.
There's a lovely picture of Marilyn Monroe in a playground in Long Island reading the end of Ulysses. So, yes, start it at the end. And and as you say, she's engaged in an activity which was unspoken, I think, in those terms in the literature of the time, and which we now recognise, of course, as one of Joyce's courageous triumphs to be able to talk about.
Yes. Stephen Connor, the novel, let's get to the reception of the novel and go. It caused a scandal when it was published. What about it was thought shocking? By that time, Joyce has linked up with various people who are going to help him. Quite a few women are going to help him, women who have access to publishing, women who have money, women who look after him onto that market, as it were, publishing a book. He's also encountered Ezra Pound, who is a great Emilio Fabre of T.S. Eliot. So he's in the middle of an intensely erudite, very significant, although tiny, literary circle. So what caused the scandal? He seemed to be quite protected.
In part, the scandal, I think, was just that Joyce let everything in. Not, I think, in any necessarily shocking way. You know, there's a scene early on in the book that even Ezra Pound thought went too far, where Bloom goes outside to the outdoor lavatory and sits there and sits on the jakes and does his business while reading. The most ordinary action, you know, that had never been described in literature before, though every reader of literature was doing it, you know, once a day if they're lucky. And probably, you know, Joyce is making you think about reading Ulysses under those circumstances. So it's partly that kind of frankness. Lots of people, when Ulysses came out in Dublin, they would go around saying, "Are you in it? Are you in it?" Because there was something, I think, disturbing, if not exactly offensive, although some publishers, early publishers of Joyce's work, were worried about it, about simply naming things, simply having living persons in your novel. I think it's still a ticklish area, actually. So there is that. And I think there's also is some curious mixture of that combined with the challenge of the ways of writing. And also, I think lots of early readers thought that this was a despairing vision of chaos and disintegration. They thought that there was nothing holding this world together, an extraordinary misreading as it now seems to us.
But it was back to the Streaky Bacon, wasn't it, of Chaucer, high and low, going hard for it. It was saturated, in parts, by this sort of determined, in-your-face sexuality, which I might have been seeded in Nora. What do you think, Jerry Johnson, was the thing you've talked to in your notes that I've read about it being funny? And can you just give listeners a notion of that element in the book?
Well, it is very funny. It's attached again and again to the quirky things of human behaviour. So, I think the funniest scene is also one of the most serious political scenes, which is the Cyclops episode, in which he's called the Citizen, is attacking Bloom. He's attacking him for being Jewish. And Bloom simply comes back and says, you know, your God was a Jew. His father was a Jew. Hang on there, I'll bloody crucify anyone for calling, you know, and so on. So very irreverent in that sense. But Bloom comes back and insists, you know, force is not the answer, love is the answer. The whole time you get this wonderful, running, abusive patter of the xenophobic Irishman who will have everything his own way. So humour is often attached to a revelation of politics and character and so on. But it is also very funny about sex. Bloom perpetually over the course of the day, every time he sees a woman, wants to follow her, hoping that the skirts will be lifted just a little higher. There's a woman who gets on the tram and he's waiting. He's waiting for the flash of stocking. And then a tram comes in between and he misses the sight and it's gone, you know. These kinds of wonderful little...
And, of course, the episode on the beach, which is very much to do with transparent
Absolutely.
Stockings.
It's the episode on the beach in which he's looking at Gertie McDowell and he masturbates. That's the episode that got him into trouble when the book was being published serially and caused the cessation of publication.
And our beginnings are our endings because we read the wonderful counsel of the man in New York that said, you know, this is... Can we just talk in the minutes we have left about the word modernism and what I know you haven't, but there you are. This is a television program. It's not a quarter of a million. It's a radio program, come to think of it. obviously overexcited having read Ulysses in a rush. what do you three mean by modernism, and how did this, as it seems, be one of the works that define modernism? start with you.
Do I get that first?
You thanks, get that first.
Yeah. Thanks, Melvin. Well, it's certainly modernism, certainly about complicating ideas of form. So the fact that you raise the question about Ulysses exciting us in that way is absolutely right. Ulysses is a book about form. It's a book where the content and the form jostle together in important ways. But it's not just that. I think we've been talking about its sexual outrageousness and its humour. And, of course, those are also important aspects of modernity. The relationship to the city, the understanding of a world of consumerism, shopping, advertising, domestic life as it's made up in the early 20th century. All of these things are absolutely vital to Joyce's modernism. But then ask Orwell, you know, he said about Ulysses that Joyce discovered the America that was under everybody's nose of everyday life. That's a key part of it too.
Joyce had a word for it, chaosmos. He invented this word.
Oh, that's great.
So the modern is chaos. It's things that don't add up.
Wasn't there chaos before the modern?
Well, there was always chaos before the modern. There were always things that couldn't be assimilated. But somehow those things seemed to everybody to be pressing in on you. Joyce said, how could you form a cosmos that would allow for that complexity rather than filtering it out?
Jerry Johnson.
And for these writers, whether we're talking about Joyce or Wolfe in particular, the form of the novel had to reflect the individual subjective experience of that chaos.
Can you just say a bit more about that, Jerry?
Certainly. If we think about the great realist novels of the 19th century, think about George Eliot, you have a third-person narrator who interprets the world without any problem. It may be a complicated world, it may be a difficult world for Dorothea, it may be a difficult world later for Gwendolyn and so on, but that narrator has no problem sorting it out. For Wolfe, for Joyce, reality is something to be read, to be interpreted, and to be presented by the novelist as filtered through those kinds of different perspectives, back to what Stephen was saying earlier about conciliation or the different perspectives that are given. So the form of the novel is having to reflect that individual experience of trying to apprehend this chaos.
Did this have a great influence? Has this had a great influence, Stephen?
Well, I think Ulysses is a kind of thesaurus of possibilities still. I don't think there is any novel that has come close to doing all of the things that Ulysses does all at once. But I think a novelist like Salman Rushdie in Midnight's Children, Thomas Pynchon in A Gravity's Rainbow, most recently David Foster Wallace in his wonderful Infinite Jest, have something of that ambition and inclusiveness and that attempt to make language come alive on a vast, precisely epic scale.
Mm-hmm. Anything to add?
Well, I think there's a huge range of influence that has to be taken into consideration from Joyce's contemporaries, Virginia Woolf, Eliot, Samuel Beckett.
Yes, I hadn't realised how much Eliot was influenced by Joyce. It was sort of as if Joyce had permitted him, influenced by it, as if Joyce had permitted him. One of the sentences, I can't remember it now, but as if Joyce had given him permission to be modern.
That's right.
Yes. So, as Steve has said, if you think about what's exciting in post-modernity or in contemporary writing, then that traces back to Joyce.
Well, I'm sorry we have to come to an end, Verry, but we haven't come to an end. It's going to be over Radio 4, and it's in bookshops. We don't sell anything on this radio. First time we've ever done it. Anyway, never mind. Thank you, Richard Brown, Steve Connor, Jerry Johnson. Next week, Annie Besant. Thanks for listening.
Thank you for listening to this Radio 4 podcast. If you've enjoyed it, you might like to try others like it, such as Start the Week or Thinking Aloud, which are both available from the Radio 4 website.
I'm Helena Bonham Carter, and for BBC Radio 4, this is History's Secret Heroes, a new series of rarely heard tales from World War II.
They had no idea that she was Britain's top female codebreaker.
We'll hear of daring risk-takers.
What she was offering to do was to ski in over the high Carpathian Mountains.
Of course it was dangerous, but danger was his friend.
Subscribe to History's Secret Heroes wherever you get your podcasts.